Welcome back to Humans of Speedway. I'm Ian Brannan and very excited to bring this episode to you where we're going to be speaking to one of the great names of British Speedway of the 80s and the 90s. Jeremy Doncaster spent most of his career riding for Ipswich Witches, but was also part of that great Reading team of the early 90s, particularly the 1992 season. Jeremy was also part of the Great Britain team that won the World Team Cup in 1989 at Bradford. He was the top scorer for Great Britain on that day with 13 points. But the meeting was marred by the crash that led to the life-changing injuries received to Eric Gunderson. We'll speak about that meeting and the rest of his career, including his appearances in World Finals. He reached three in total and particularly in Munich had a runoff for second place with his great friend Simon Wigg. We'll also hear about his Czech golden helmet times, adventures across Europe in the days when travel was a little more restrictive, and plus we're going to hear about Jeremy Doncaster's dream meeting in Speedway Paradise at the end as well, describing where his dream meeting would be and who would be riding in it. So sit back and relax, pour yourself a glass of something nice, whatever that might be, and enjoy the company of one of Great Britain's great Speedway riders, Jeremy Doncaster. Welcome to Humans of Speedway.
Thank you.
Here he is, and we've made it through almost 1 year of lockdown at the time of recording, and we're heading into 2021. Before we start with looking back on your career, what are you up to these days, Jeremy? I think would be one of the main questions probably people are wondering now.
Well, I have worked all the way through the pandemic, so I'm actually work on an MOD site, you know, on the local airfield at Watersham.
Oh, okay.
As a project manager. So as you can imagine, because of COVID, there was a lot of extra work we had to put in place. And obviously the world doesn't stop as far as defence is concerned. So we've never been so busy, to be honest. Really busy. My heart goes out to a lot of people who have their businesses have suffered, particularly Speedway, as in the entertainment businesses and your day to day, your food, your pubs, your restaurants. I mean, my heart goes out for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully, though, once we get through all this, some Speedway at the end of it, and let's hope it can be a better year than 2020 was, fingers crossed. Let's turn about our attention to your story then, Jeremy. I mean, where does your relationship with bikes go back to? I mean, from the earliest age, what's your earliest memory of getting on a bike? I mean, was it a motorbike or was it, like many of us, with stabilisers wobbling around?
Well, I didn't have stabilisers, but I had an old moped I bought off Alec Gooch. We call him Alec the Jap. You know, he's still active on social media with his. He's got so many of them and restored so many of them. So he sold me a mobilette moped, and it was all cut down with without the pedals, or one pedal was a footrest on one side, and. And I rode around the back garden at my dad's. And then because we got complaints from the neighbours, because it didn't have any baffles in the exhaust pipe, it's just like a real noisy, annoying lawnmower, really. So you can understand it, really. The neighbours soon got fed up. And I was quite fortunate because down the road lived someone called Pete Davey, who owned Davey Brothers Motorcycles, who he kind of... popped around and says, you may be interested in this. There's a Norfolk and Suffolk Motorcycle Club has just launched, and it's for, and they're looking for members. So, you know, you're upsetting the neighbours round here, so it doesn't upset me. But, do you want to come along and have a look and join? And I did. And the other thing is that built up a relationship with me and Pete and Davey Brothers. And they kind of took me under their wing, really, and supported me. I worked in a motorbike shop before I left school, really. I mean, the school used to ring up and find and say, "Where the hell are you? And where is he?" And he said, "Yeah, he's all right. He's safe, so don't worry." And Yeah, and they support me through the grass tracking. And because it's a Honda agency as well, so I had the backing of Honda UK, which I won a British Championship on in the early 80s. And first bike was a 500 Jet, and which I restored and is in the workshop today.
Oh, wow. So you still got the original bike?
I've got the first and I've got the last. I've got the one I broke my leg on in my farewell in Germany, in Nandlstadt. That last ever race, and ended up with quite a badly broken leg. So that was just a warning shot. Thought I was going to get away with it all after 25 years plus. And it was, just a little wake-up call that was.
Severe injuries are a reality of Speedway. Of course, you never know what's around the corner, but it's unfortunate when you have such a long and illustrious career in the sport, similar to when I spoke to Gary Havelock a while ago, that when you go out for what should be a routine ride and your career is ended there and then, you know, you haven't got the chance to do the big farewell and all that kind of stuff. It's sort of a sad way to, an unfortunate way as well, to end a great career.
No, that's right. I mean, Heavy's was life-changing as well. And, and my brother had a life-changing injury as well, similar to Gary's, where he lost the use of his arm. And he overcame it in his garage business. He had several operations and managed to get partial use back in it. So he was able to not be disabled as such. Mm-hmm. Still just slightly disabled, but you wouldn't actually notice it. And he went on to get an ACU like motocross license, and the medical panel came and viewed him, watched him ride, and said, yeah, he's safe enough to have a license again. So he sort of rode with a partial disability, which was amazing, really. But it does, you get injuries, and small injuries. I mean, I've ridden with sort of partially healed collarbones, and they're dreadfully painful, and it really does slow you down. And niggling injuries like strained knees and ligaments, and the season's only short, so you have to knuckle on and get on with it and block out the pain. And obviously, we had some quite fortunate physiotherapists who were on top of the game at the time, specialising in sports injuries. People like Brian Simpson was local in Ipswich, and in actual fact, he looked after a lot of the footballers and sports injuries, and he used to say the Speedway guys are a lot tougher, as in you want to earn money, you want to ride, and he said, I know that, you know, what I'm doing, it may speed, it may help to the process of healing, but he said it won't. He said, if you ride, that'll be painful. There's no doubts about it.
It's one of those things, though, that makes Speedway what it is, isn't it? Where you get riders who, for whatever reason, whether it's the money, whether it's they don't want to give their team place up, whether it's fighting for a world championship, that they do find a way of going through the pain barrier. And it just shows what tough characters Speedway riders are, or maybe what crazy characters they are.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head, really. I think it really depends how high your pain threshold is, really. Some can do it and some can't, you know. So, you know, take me out to anyone who can, you know, it's fair play. But it does knock you back a bit, and if to try to find form and try to earn money out of it, and try, which is obviously scoring points, it does make it a lot tougher than it already is. It's already got so many variables in it anyway, as in track conditions and sort of, you know, if you choose a correct bike or whatever you're doing on the particular night, if you're feeling good as well in yourself, that's so much of it. There's so many variables. You know, if someone's upset you just before you're going out for a race, you know, that all plays on your mind.
I always remember that footage of Kenny Carter trying to get to the world final with a broken leg, and he was being lifted out of his wheelchair and onto a bike and then back off again afterwards. You know, I think that kind of level is, the extreme, isn't it?
Well, I was actually in that British final and I think the one afterwards as well, and I just couldn't believe it.
Well, if you look at the boots, you can see the difference in size. And I've got to have a special cast on, so I have no movement on my right leg. So it's hard work when you're riding because you can't maneuver the bike the same, so it's difficult.
He won the British final with a broken leg, and it was a solid plaster cast, it was. He couldn't, how the hell, he managed to do it. I don't think he's in particular pain, but it shows what tremendous skill he had to ride. Mind you, commentary and probably any other track where you've got to turn really, really hard and sharp, you may have struggled. But certainly at commentary, it's fairly slick that day, so it's quite easy to ride. And of course, he was making tremendous starts.
If this meeting would have been nowhere else in England, everybody would have rode, they would have had to ride. I think they will ride today. But if you look on the inside where people's rode, it's dry. I mean, you can see the track over there. There's no problem. It's on the outside where it's wet, but nobody rides there. And I think the problem is, because it's raining, a few riders have scored no points or 1 point, and they don't want to carry on. I've won one race. I might come last in my next race, but I've got a broken leg. I've got a broken leg, and I'd like to ride. If it was that bad, I wouldn't want to ride. But
referee's just announced we're carrying on.
But if you look at the track at Oxford, I've got a video of that meeting, and the track was worse than this, and it was pissing down.
It was raining.
Yeah.
Yeah, he showed true Yorkshire grit,
From where putting it.
Brilliant rider.
So you came through the grass track scene, which so many riders of your era did, and it was it was a great grounding that's not really there so much now and not so prevalent. It's more sort of motocross, if anything, isn't it, that's leading to Speedway these days. But it was a great grounding because a lot of the riders, I imagine, that you were riding with grass track and so on also went to join you in Speedway.
Well, that's right, yeah. So there's me, Wiggy, Simon Cross, even Kelvin. He went from motocross to Speedway and then on grass track as well. So, and I think when you're Peter Collins is another one. When you're involved in the different disciplines of the sport, you have a track racing license. That's what they call it, track racing, and that covers you for all disciplines, which is ice speedway, which I didn't actually do. I mean the indoor, but it's ice speedway, sand track, long track, speedway. So you might as well use it.
Yeah,
cost you £350 a year or whatever it was. I think it was then. So you might as well ride in the vents, and you could quite often. You could have a rolling chassis sitting there and just bolt one of your speedway engines in, which up to about 800 metres, 600 to 800 metres was ample quick enough. It was only when you went on the full 1,000 metres you really needed something, something a bit special, or probably something off one of the engine tuners. Yeah, that's because it's just, you haven't really got much time to get things right on those 1,000 metres, so it's probably better. It's easier just to get a rental for the day.
Yeah, I spoke to Kelvin Tatum before Christmas in, I think, actually the last episode before the end of the year last year. And, he was talking about long track. Obviously, he firmly covered long track, but he went on to long track after the majority of his speedway career, if you know what I mean. He sort of focused on that later on.
Yeah, I was obviously racing through that era as well with Kelvin. Yeah. So Kelvin and Simon as well. So I think he did have a go initially. He went to Herxheim early on and didn't have a very good time of it. And I remember him saying, he said, I'm going to come back to this because this is something needs more time and attention. And probably it may have been 7 or 8 years before he actually came back to it. And then but gave it his all, you know, and fair play to him. In actual fact, I've got his book for Christmas, so, and I've just been, I haven't read much of it yet, but the first four chapters, and got to his wife Debbie's part, and just said to my wife, I said, it's very, very familiar story, that is, you know. You know, tough life, very selfish people we are. And you had to bring up the family single-handedly, basically.
Oh, well, it's resonated with you then.
Yeah, it's very. I don't know what the next chapters are going to be, but I should imagine they're fairly similar.
Well, I mean, from my memory and it might be slightly hazy or incorrect, but the way I saw Speedway at the time, and now when I was growing up, I was a Halifax fan, and then Halifax, of course, moved to Bradford. So only used to get to see you when you were a visiting rider more often than not, despite what Wikipedia says that you were a Bradford rider, which is, I believe, incorrect.
That is incorrect. Yeah, I don't know how they get the wrong information, really, but... Yeah. But I used to love Halifax, actually. It's one of my favourite tracks, one of them. I can remember first going there for the Witches, well, in 82, when I first started. And Kevin Jolly was says, oh, he said, oh, you wait till you get to Halifax. And, you know, I had this picture of this. He said, the banking, you've never seen banking like it. And I was... expected to see this track like a bank in the size of a house, do you know what I mean? I was going to the meeting with him, I was actually terrified what it's going to be like. And when I looked at it, I said, that's nothing. He said, what do you mean? He said, I've ridden grass tracks with more banking than that. And he said, where? And I said, well, Stats Canal in Holland. I said, it's got double the bank in Halifax. So I just was like a duck to water, you know, straight up to the top of the, you know, at the top of the bank in and running down it, and had a whale of a time. Used to love it, absolutely love it.
A lot of people found it a little bit narrow, but it was certainly a fast track that I remember, and the memories are fairly hazy, but it was big. I remember the big bends, and there was a lot of passing on the bends, particularly there at Halifax, as I recall.
That's right. Yeah, I mean you can use the bank, and it's if you read it right, you could say you could go up to the bank and make a straight off the top of it. You know, turn at the top of it, make the big long straight, and pass people on the exit of the corners, and just before it narrows up on the straight. If you left it a little bit too late, then you nipped your opponent up against the fence a little bit, which they probably didn't really like that too much.
It was always a bit of a cinder track as well, wasn't it, rather than shale that you get these days. It was always more of a grey appearance.
Yeah, I like the surface, actually. It's very much very consistent. And it never used to sort of chop up like the red shale. The red shale used to get quite quite holey, and sometimes if it rained, it used to get quite heavy and lumpy. But that surface, that cinders, that is more to be honest, it's more like the early Polish tracks. Hmm. You know, they had that type of surface where you just sort of prepared it with water, and you could sort of use the water, pull all the stuff back, relay it, and you're constantly sort of having a new track after every batch of sort of four, six races, whenever you want to feel like preparing the track again. So it's quite unique. I think there probably should be more of it, but sadly that went, didn't it?
Yeah, it did, and I mean, the Shea is still there, but it's just a football ground now. No speedway track around it. Of course, they moved to Bradford in 1986, yeah. I think it was, after the World Final in 85.
I rode with Kenny, actually, on the trial meeting in at Bradford when the Ham Brothers moved up, and they opened it up, didn't they, with Eric Boothroyd. And Yeah, with Kenny. Kenny did the press launch, and then we had a practice, and then we had one of the World Team Cup qualifiers there. I think Ivan was riding there with his son Kim, and it's me, Kenny. Might have been Kelvin as well. I think we were. That's when John Berry was England team manager, and he was going for more, for the youth. I think Mort was still in it. I can't remember, to be honest. It's a little bit of a... That's the trouble. It all becomes a bit of a blur.
I remember yourself and... I mean, what I was getting around to saying actually before was that I remember yourself and Kelvin actually kind of being the... coming through the ranks with the what was then the England team. And it seemed... Certainly my impression in my mind was that it was the two of you really were the new order and you were taking over from the kind of the old guard, if you want to call them that, of the sort of late 70s, early 80s. And it sort of seemed to be yourself and Kelvin that were leading that charge. And then there was Wiggy also there as well. And then Chris Louie and riders like that all sort of got in on the end.
You pretty much summed it up, to be honest. And I say we were taken over from the old guard with, PC and Mort. They were still competitive, but perhaps a little bit, lost their edge a little bit. I think it needed fresh blood, which, of course, when we first started, we were, lacking experience and had to grow up pretty damn quick. But also we had to raise our game, and we could see that we needed to do it, and we had to learn how to do it as well. And the Danes were so good at that time.
Jeremy Doncaster in blue, next to him in yellow and black, Eric Goodison. With three, we'll have Chris Morton, and on the outside, Hans Nielsen in white. The Danes won heat one in a canter. England have fought back now, just 8 points down. It's an important heat five, psychologically as well as on track. Under orders now. A long time, and up to the first corner. It looks as though England's got away. It's a terrific start from the England pairing. Goodison makes his run down the inside. It's Morton in front. Second place is Doncaster. Third place is Goodison and Nielsen busting a gun around the outside now. And we have a fair speedway race on now.
And with the help of British Coal as well, Coal Products Limited, and under the different banners.
Yeah, Sunbright, and things like
Home
that.
Home Fire, Furnacite, Ansett Fuels. And I say with Simon, or the two Simons, Simon Wigg, Simon Cross, Kelvin as well. And Kelvin got support later on from them. That kind of helped to raise our game, and it wasn't just equipment. A lot of it, some of it was equipment. We didn't always have the quantity of fast stuff or bikes we preferred to ride. So we had to sort of slowly build up a stable of good equipment, which is hard to do. Particularly when the early GMs, you could get a rocket ship one week and then the next minute it's you got it in a bin. they used to just blow up so often, it's just as well Sunbright did sponsors, because with explosions like that, you could sort of do several thousand pounds worth of damage within a couple of weeks. And the other thing was the mental thing, and that was possibly the hardest, and which took the longest to get our heads around to get that level up, and I think when we were ready for it at Bradford, and that was so unfortunate when Eric had his crash, and we all felt for it, and you can imagine how deflated the England side were with Colin Pratt you know, being the team manager for Cradley. He was a shadow of himself. He really was. And you know, although we're rivals on the track, rival countries, but we're all good buddies as well. So effectively all of us, but we're ready to put on the show, and I think the Danes were ready for a strong fight, and I think even had Eric not had his crash, I think we would have won that day anyway. But it's just unfortunate that of what happened, really.
As riders, how aware of the severity of the situation were you? Obviously, there was British riders, English riders caught up in that crash as well, because all four riders went down. How aware were you as to how severe this was?
We knew more than the public knew. We could tell something wasn't quite right, the way Peter York was relaying messages, which I think Pete was absolutely shocked. And it's a very, very difficult situation to announce to the public, really. We knew things weren't right, and we spoke to Hans and the Danish team manager, and they were really, really worried about him, and obviously his wife Hella went to the hospital in the ambulance, and she was called down, and so we knew it was very serious. And because Simon Cross as well, he took a tumble, I think Ricky Miller as well, so I think all four in that that race. Obviously Eric had life-changing injuries, didn't he? I mean, that's one of the things when you get on the way at the meeting, the law of averages. You're gonna have a get off and have a crash, and you might hurt yourself, you might break something, but you don't really think you're gonna not come home that day with with life-changing injuries, and that's sort of the luck of the draw, I guess, or the roll of the dice.
Yeah, I mean, back to what we were saying earlier about injuries. I know that when I spoke to Gary Havelock, and he was saying about, you know, well, he's had a life-changing injury, but he's still thankful in some respects, because, you know, he hasn't had an injury like that, or like Darcy Ward, or so many others in the past. Yeah. That have, Per Jonsson, of course, you know, one of
Lawrence Hare. I mean, there's Joe Owen, Alan Wilkinson. I mean, it does happen, you know, and it does, that just brings it home to you.
We'll talk more about that meeting in just a bit, because obviously it was a major event, the World Team Cup in 1989. We'll come back to that. I'm just going to talk about your time at Ipswich first, because you were a big rider for your local team, spent the most time of any of your clubs at Ipswich, and it must be great riding for your hometown club.
Yes, living in the town, that was really fortunate. One thing, it's not far to travel at the meetings.
Yeah, makes it handy.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a good vibes in the town. You know, I was like the new kid on the block when I started in 82. I had a couple of stints. I had 10 years at Reading. Or was it? No, 5 years at Reading in between. So, but I had my 10-year testimonial at Reading that followed on from when I had to leave Ipswich, when they dropped down to the National League, or the Second Division. I was in the blaze of glory to be the new John Lewis, and which is, you know, going to be a tough act to follow. And it took a little while to find my feet. I think I ended up the year with a broken ankle, but I did manage to get one paid maximum in my first British League season, which I was quite chuffed with, and a fairly healthy average. But I think the deep tracks, early season tracks, the late season tracks, I think the ability of the advantage of having the experience of the grass tracks and the long tracks, the multi-discipline sport, helped speed my development up. And I think I made a 83 was a bit of a standstill year. I did manage to win the European Grass Track Championship in 82 as well, which was the debut Speedway season. And that kind of, when things were going bad on the Speedway, or not how I wanted it to go on the Speedway, at the weekends I was grass tracking somewhere, and that gave me something to regain my confidence. I hadn't got to dwell on things. I hadn't had time to dwell on things, which was good. I was very busy. And and that I think that was probably a bit of advantage, having another discipline, not in your local town, because you're not hearing how dreadful you did that night. Or
and the grass track, a much more obviously continental thing as well, because you'd be travelling to places like Germany and Belgium and places like that, I imagine, for these rounds.
That's right, yeah, and it wasn't so easy getting about those days either. You had to have carnets for your bikes, which I was kind of dreading it. Brexit, when they're talking about the borders and bits and pieces. I thought, well, yeah, we're going backwards, and I can remember exactly what it's like. I can remember going through. We had to build up, buy these carnets for the bikes, and you stamp in each country, and then you stamp them out of each country. You go through, and sometimes you sort of when you've only got say 26 sheets of paper left in your carnet, and you think, well, I've got another few trips to do yet. You try and just stamp in out of one country like France and out of France, and try and sneak through Belgium, Holland, and into Germany. But the issue with doing that is if you got caught, you got sent all the way back to the country where you should have stamped into.
Oh,
so,
man.
Yeah, which it's happened. It's happened twice. You know, I've got, and it's normally in Holland, and trying going out of Holland, they're just waiting for you, and they say, well, and they actually followed us up the road, pulled us in, the customs has said, you haven't stamped for your bikes. You must go back. And they followed us for 3.5 hours back to the border to make sure I got the stamp.
Oh, wow. Said,
yeah.
So you had to drive all the way back across Holland again and then obviously do your Germany journey you were originally going to do.
Yes, that's right, yeah. Yeah. So, it's a slap on the wrist, that was.
Yeah.
So either that or get arrested.
Because in this time as well, you're talking about obviously the Berlin Wall would still be up, and it's the Cold War and the Iron Curtain, and having to try and visit all these places. I suspect that you've got stories of extreme travel. I know that I saw something in the Speedway Star a while back that you went to Russia, I think you went well prepared, didn't you?
Well, we did in Russia. I mean, all those Eastern Bloc countries, you had to be well prepared. And one of the biggest issues was you had to get an invite from the governing body to actually for the event before you could apply for a visa. So you could imagine sort of if you're riding in Poland or Czechoslovakia or even I think it was Rovno, wasn't it? No, not Rovno. That was where is it? The Russian semi-final. That is, but you can imagine that your passport was away permanently, applying for permits and visas. So I had to go to the town hall. I had to run two passports to get through the season. although you probably get strung up today, but well, you would get strung up for sure. But then you could apply for your the passports were issued, or the yearly passports were issued from the town hall. So I had to go to the town hall and and speak to her very nicely, explain the situation with my dates and where I was going to, and explain that I needed to get a yearly passport, a temporary passport, while my permanent passport was away, and they, which you're not actually supposed to do, but they did actually, they had the, what was they called, discrepancy to do that. There's several things going on in the Eastern Bloc. I said the borders opened up in 89, and I think that was that, Rovno, that was it 89 or 90, I can't remember, but that was around that time. And when we got back to the Polish border, you'll probably read it in the Speedway Star, but Gorbachev had got kidnapped. So had we not left then, because Peter Collins came with us as well, as one thing he wanted to go to Russia, and the other thing he's good to have around, you know, and for meetings like that as well. And and we wanted to stay an extra couple of days and sort of have a good look around the place. But when we realised that that wasn't going to happen, and that was more or less instant, as soon as we got through the Polish border into the Ukraine, and we had literally police escort at the front, police escort at the back, and it was all the nations, you know, everyone met, you know, at just before the border in Brest. And that was, I think Ty's dad, Rob Ruffenden, was on that trip. I think he was with Billy Hamill, I believe, helping out Billy. So,
oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, he was, yeah. So he often used to say, he said, oh, you don't get many trips like that anymore, do you? I said, no, you don't. I said, and the thing is, you ought to talk to the ICE guys as well, Abdi Group and people like that, because we used to see them in the grass tracks, and they used to be ice racers as well in the winter. And they'll tell you stories where they got hijacked, you know, try to find these speedway tracks in Russia where they get robbed. You know, they go in a big bus and they just get stopped but on the side of the road with, you know, rocket launchers, not just your sort of, you know, AK-47s. They're just...
God.
Yeah, they can tell you some hell of a stories. And so we were worried, and we were prepared. So, yeah, there's a few of them.
that was to get to the 1991 World Final, from looking at it.
Gothenburg, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, another plane after that World Final. I had another nightmare plane journey after that as well, with Mitch Shearer. That was in that Vilgard. It's painted like a dragonfly, that was. We went to Gothenburg Airport and looked at this plane, and it had wheels on it the size of a wheelbarrow, and we were going. It took us 7 hours in Poland. We had to land somewhere for fuel. I don't know where we landed, but never went through any customs. Took off again on a grass field. We're overweight, could barely take off. When we did take off, we had to do a hard sort of right turn, just miss the top of a church spire, and me and Mitch, we're just like, we're not going to survive this. You know, that one stage going across the sea, we're actually going sideways. We weren't going forwards. So we actually landed and got to the track. We actually got off the plane and kissed the grass, you know, just actually kissed it.
it shouldn't take 7 hours to get from Sweden to Poland, I'm pretty sure.
No, it shouldn't do. No,
they've had you on going round in circles.
Yeah, if there's a strong headwind and you're going against it, it does.
My God.
Yeah.
It's a nightmare.
Yeah, that was a nightmare. It really was. I mean, I spoke to Mitch last year. He rang up, and the first thing he said was, oh, do you remember that trip to Poland, you know, from Sweden to Poland? And I went, oh no, that plane, unbelievable.
it's not the speedway that's dangerous by the sound of it, it's the transport.
Yeah, you're right, yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah, we've had some horrendous trips, yeah.
And the couple of years before that, on the World Championship front, as we mentioned, Gothenburg. But your biggest success would be in Munich at the Olympic Stadium there, 1989. I mean, what are your memories of that meeting?
Well, 89 was a good year, sort of like team-wise, individual-wise, and the World Team Cup. We achieved in Munich.
The track here is 400 metres, the shale for Speedway laid directly on the running surface. This makes it a little narrow for Speedway, and the starts are going to be vital. Once in front, a rider will be in charge. Passing will probably be at a premium. For heat number one, on the inside, Jeremy Doncaster from England in the red helmet colour. Bohumil Brahel from Prague, Czechoslovakia. Gate two, Mitch Shearer, gate three. And Andy Smith from England, gate four. And into the first bend and coming through on the inside, Jeremy Doncaster pursued quickly by the New Zealander, Mitch Shearer. Shearer trying to get through on the inside, but Doncaster holding him. Back in third is Andy Smith. And at the back, the Czechoslovakian looks outclassed.
To get in a runoff for second place. Shame I didn't win the runoff, but it was probably the worst start I made all night. Well, it was the worst start I made all night. Lack of concentration.
It was a runoff with Simon Wigg, a good friend of yours as well.
That's right, yeah. I remember we stood on the rostrum and he said, this will sort us out for the long track for a few more years now. You know, and I said, yeah, okay. And we sort of like, we're chatting away and sort of... working out how much start money we can ask.
Your value just went up.
It was on the rostrum. Yeah, it did, yeah. Because quite often the Germans at least they like watching the British battle, you know, on the grass tracks. Hans Zerk used to love it. He says, oh, the two Englishmen, they are fighting so hard. You know, and we'll have... really good races abroad, me and Simon.
But the man who won the world title, 29-year-old Dane from Brost, Hans Nielsen, Simon Wigg in second place, Jeremy Doncaster third, four English riders in the top seven, quite a day for British Speedway. But the man who won the world title undoubtedly celebrates in the Olympic Stadium in Munich. He is, of course, Hans Nielsen.
89 was having a good year, and probably 1990, I was probably even 1990, really, was the one where the final would have been at Bradford had I would have made it. And I went out at Felsted, but that was the year where I thought, well, I can be world champion that year. And Hans was difficult, was harder to beat than Eric, to be honest. Although, like I was saying, we had learned how to up our game and raise our game. And we were able to do it at the higher at that level in the higher meetings, and the world final at Munich just sort of rubber stamped that. So 1990 was for me should have been the one, but so it went pear shaped at Felsted, and I won the overseas final on a 15-point maximum, and then. And then Hardy scored a point in Denmark, which had dreadfully slipped, which is just totally caught us out, which is a shame, because Bradford was one of my favourite tracks, I certainly rode well there, as well as anyone else there. Obviously, Reading, Per was one of my teammates. Well, he was my teammate. And I actually went up there and mechanic for... Mando, actually. I was in his corner of the pits. I was talking to Per, you know, through the meeting. Well, actually, he wasn't talking a lot because he's in there just so focused. He was, no one could talk to him, to be honest. It's just more or less curled up in a ball, just sort of like shaking, I think that's the word.
Yeah, I was at the 1990 World Final, and it was an exciting meeting, and it would have lent itself to you though, because you were a fan of Bradford, I think, as a rider. You always seemed to do pretty well there.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So I was there on one of the opening rounds for the World Team Cup qualifiers, and always scored well there, and like the big open space, the banking, could use the banking. Yeah, love the place. But it wasn't to be. Yeah, can't. It's life, isn't it, really? Sometimes it goes your way, sometimes it doesn't go your way. I mean, you look at 91 World Final at Gothenburg, it's good to get there. Shocking meeting. We're there for 3 days, couldn't get any of the bikes through the scrutineers with the noise control. And I'm sure something was going on there with the noise control because I don't know, but I know Mitch kicked it across the centre green, which probably didn't help. And he asked for the calibrations to do again. He said, well, I didn't calibrate it now as he boots it across the centre green. So, I mean, that probably didn't help.
It's one way of dealing with it.
I had to borrow a... Yeah, I had to race with a borrowed silencer off a vintage bike in the car park. And that just about knocked any horsepower the poor thing had. You know, so you might as well just cross us out of the book on that one. And I was bitterly disappointed. But I think from that, I mean, I was heavily involved in the making of those silencers as well. You know, the straight through pipe with Richard Arben. With Hans, Jan Anderson, we were for the straight through silencer. So we were putting a testing regime and a report to the BSBA and said that for safety reasons, these are probably the safer to use than the megaphones.
Right.
Which at the time, I think at the time they wanted to go to 28 mil restrictors, which we tried those with a comparison to a straight through silencer, and the straight through silencer had a double win, really, that had reduced noise and obviously a smoother power delivery, which we felt for new guys coming in the sport, new riders trying to have a feel for the bike, would improve the safety of the sport, which that sold it to the BSBA, and obviously then it followed on for the FIM, and then after that all the noise controls went out the window because they're all rubber stamps with a hologramation mark on them.
When you look at the machines from the time when you were riding, you were very much in the upright era, which Upright Speed will be very pleased about, I'm sure. But when you look at the modern machines, because you are one of the machine examiners at Ipswich, so you get to have a good look at the modern bikes that are being used now, lay down engines and all sorts of tweaks that come along from season to season. Are we in a better place now with the current machinery, or were the old uprights still the best?
Well, it's questionable, really, because I mean, an example is, I'm probably told the story before, but I was invited back to the Czech Golden Helmet, their 70th anniversary a couple of years ago, and it was all the past winners were invited, and John Davis is there, my old buddy Dennis Segalos as well, and Hans Nielsen. Yuri Stansel and Ollie Olsen, and we all stopped at the same place and had supper together, and we're chatting away, and actually at the stadium we were in their bureau, and on their back wall they've got an engraving of I suppose it's like a golf. You know, they have past winners and the times and the results of the top six in the final, you know, from 470 years. And we went through it, and with Ollie, and we said, oh, look, that's because Ollie won stacks of them, you know, six, you know. And I said, oh, look at the times. He said, yeah, that'd be on the two valve jow, that'd be the long stroke one, that would be the short stroke two valve, you know. And I said, well, look at the times. And then we went when Dennis won it on you know, the four valve Wesley, and there's probably like 4 seconds different. And then sort of like the next 5 years, and I won, you know, one in 89 and then another one in 90. And I was on upright GMs then, but we had like a decent bit of rubber, you know, we had soft compound tires. And then you go back 30 years, I think Jason Doyle's won it two or three times, I think, the last couple of years. It's probably two, but his first time he won, which was written on the board, I saw, look at the time, and there's not even a tenth of a second between his winning time and my winning time in 89. And I said, well, look at that. And Ollie said, well, that can't be right. And he said, this, well, that's the answer then. We go back to uprights. And we had a decent time.
Oh, my word, the noise, the atmosphere is electric. Doncaster on the outside, and Casper now comes up to take the lead. Casper takes the lead, Doncaster back on him. My word, what a race. What a race as they come out of the final two turns. And it's going to be Doncaster the wins. Doncaster gets to the checkered flag in first place. Second place is Tony Casper. Third is Zdenek Tesar. Fourth is Gary Havelock. Fifth, Mitch Shearer. Sixth, Paul Thorpe. But just look at Jeremy Doncaster. He's so pleased with life. Shaking hands with Tony Casper, Gary Havelock, and all the rest of them. But Jeremy Doncaster, of course, from the Reading 4X Racers in England, who has done the work, but had to overcome a terrific challenge by Tony Casper on the last lap. All the track staff, and there we see Martin Dugard, the first one out to congratulate him. His mechanic, Dougie, and are we going to get the traditional bumps? We'll have to wait and see if they will.
There has been a hell of a lot of change, and then obviously went to lay down after that, but we went on less rubber. And I think probably the modern day speed riders today, they haven't learned with the different disciplines of the sport, and when you've got a decent tire under you and you have to be over the front all the time to sort of counterbalance any type of hole or grip, you know. I mean, we could sort of ride through a real rough track with holes, and if you're up over the front of the bike and roll the throttle off and you got your weight in the right place, you could pass people through the holes in control. But when I look at some of the GPs, you have one hole and they're off the back of the thing, and they're just in the air fence, and I think, well, and they blame the track, and I thought, well, that can't be right, you know. No one blames the track. The track didn't cause the crash.
How about looking at the guy on the bike?
Well, exactly, yeah. And that's how things have changed. And I don't think they ride, the successful riders, the modern day riders of today who are still successful or very successful, are the up front, over the front riders who've got that control. And that's probably... because they've learned that way. But the ones hanging off the thing, I don't think they probably won't race for 30 years, or 25, 30 years, shall I say, because they're just sort of, you think, well, blimey, I don't think they're going to make tomorrow, no matter then, you know.
Mm. You know, you can't be old-fashioned technique.
No, I mean, we still had good races. We could sort of respected each other as they do today, but it felt safer. You could. I mean, I used to ride shoulder to shoulder with Armando Castagna at Reading, and we'd literally be rubbing shoulders, team riding down the straight for four laps. We used to frighten each other, because we still hit a few holes and. But we were able to control them, you know. We could control it with the throttle, with the bikes, you know. And if it picked a bit more grip, you just sort of rolled it off, and it took you away from the fence. It appears to be nowadays, if you pick up, hit some dirt, it pulls you into the fence, which the bikes never used to do that with the era I rode. Later on they did, but the early laydowns, when we adapted them, they were probably the easiest and probably the safest to ride. So perhaps go revert back to what the guys were riding probably 10 years ago, and it maybe a few less crashes, perhaps.
So.
And a decent tyre. You give them a decent tyre, and you know, the guys will have to ride up over the front, otherwise they wouldn't stay on them. And you do, there is one heck of a difference, but I say the modern day speedway rider today, they're not doing the multi-discipline sports. So, all right, some of them are very talented and very good motorcyclists who do come from a motocross background as well, so they can ride bikes. But I think the mixture, you know, a weekend on a grass track bike, a long track bike, midweek in the speed on the speedway, I think that kept you alert and on top of your game. And I think it's definitely a help for me. And I know it was for Simon, and probably if you ask Kelvin, he would probably say the same.
Yeah, absolutely. And it just broadens your experience as well, doesn't it, across the whole sport? And there's different things you can take from each discipline, I suppose, that helps you out overall.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Cardiff, that famous Tony Rickardson, when he sort of just rode the boards, didn't he, and sort of rode the berm, and it was like his wheels were just absolutely straight. He just parked it like a road racer, and rode the berm, sort of road raced it, half road race, half motocross, and just put it in there, and actually lent it round, which is multi-talented.
Yeah, the only person I've seen do something similar was Greg Hancock, and I guess he's a sort of rider who's got that skill set as well, of being able to pull that kind of move off.
Yeah, that's right, that comes up. Yeah, similar sort of rider, up over the front type. Or the only other guy I've seen do that is George Hack, and that was in Marmon. But his two-wheeling was about 2.5 foot along the fence. And then tail off the fence. That's taken a bit too far. And he didn't crash.
And moderate it somewhere.
And he passed me and Peter Collins while he's doing it. We couldn't believe it.
Wow. You're looking around thinking, what has happened?
Yeah, well, we both did. Yeah, and the race was stopped, and I think Smudger Andy Smith was riding it, and I think he ended up in a ditch on the inside somewhere. And we just chatted, and I said, is it my eyes or did I just see something? He said, well, no, that was George. And I went, and we looked at the fence, and it was about a good 2.5 foot up the fence, his rear tire, front and rear, he'd gone the whole wall of death,
incredible. Living the dream.
Yeah.
I want to talk to you about Reading before we move on, because again, a very successful part of your career, and a team that you did very well with, and particularly 1990 and 1992 winning the league championship must be part of your career highlights, being involved in that team and being the captain as well, I believe, in that Reading team.
Yes, I was. Yeah, I was very proud to be captain of, all the successes, really. And like I say, I was captain, but we're all captains in our own right, and that's why it worked. I mean, and it's not often you get you gel with the guys, and when it does, you just take on the world, and we did, and we had tremendous success, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And also Pat Bliss and Bill Dorr, they led from the top as well. I mean, they were a lot of it. They looked after us very well. A lot of the deals we did was just a handshake, and which is old school deals and true to the word. So I mean that kind of sets the precedence and mutual respect for everyone. And I like to think probably when you look at some of the riders in the team, obviously Per, I mean, very tragic his accident he had. But if you look at Tony Olsen, Amanda Castagna, how they, their input in the sport since their Reading days, you kind of wonder, well, you know, they're very intelligent, very, very intelligent people.
Tony Olsen and Armando Castagna, and of course Phil Morris is involved in that team as well. So you've got the full FIM complement.
Well, yeah, you kind of wonder. It makes you think. Well, was it a coincidence, or was it? It was because we started something and it evolved from there, which is I don't know, but it doesn't. Yeah.
Well, I did the interview with Phil Morris last summer, and he did allude to the fact that Armando kind of took him under his wing at Reading, and has done so at the FIM as well. So it's very much a Reading loving at the top echelons of the GP.
Yeah. It has to be, you know. And probably if I wasn't doing what I was doing job wise, I probably would be, probably another one as well. But obviously, I had to go a different path work-wise, and that sort of kept us away from. I kept involved in Ipswich, but that's probably as limits as much as I could do.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating, and I think it shows what a good team can do as well, and it's the right thing, isn't it? If you know people that are going to be good at the job, then why not get them involved?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even guys like Dave Mallett, I mean, he was struggling a little bit, but we all rallied round and sort of said, well, have a go on this one, have a go on that. And we all of us were just saying, well, try my engine, try that one. Until he found something, he said, God, I like this. And he was just as good as anyone. He could beat any number one round Reading is incredible. And it just seemed anyone who was part of that team just got dragged along with it, really, without putting pressure on anyone. And that's because we all talked as well. You know, we all talked with each other, and we all, we're all perfectly open. We all helped each other as well. And which is... And that was doesn't happen very often. Doesn't even happen in the workplace very often.
Yeah, but it is the key, I think. You know, communication, helping each other out, and working as one unit rather than a bunch of individuals.
That's, you hit the nail on the head. Absolutely.
We're going to do your Fantasy Speedway meeting very soon in our Speedway Paradise feature before we finished, Jeremy. But first of all, a couple of questions. I opened it up before we were recording this. I said if anybody had any questions for Jeremy Doncaster to let us know. Here's a few of them. Kicking off with Gary Schofield, who has a question about your favourite sort of track. And I think we've probably alluded to the answer, but he says, would you prefer the tight technical track like, say, Wolves, or somewhere a bit bigger like Bellevue? Which sort of track would you prefer to ride on?
Well, they've both got their own challenges. I'd say out of the two, Bellevue or the technical track, I'd go for the Bellevue. I used to like the small technical Wolverhampton track, but on this occasion, I'd say, looking at the new Nationals track, I'd really like to have a go on that at some time.
There's one here that says, it's a photo, which obviously you can't see, but it's a newspaper article, and the headline is Racing Richard Meets His Biking Hero. And the message is from Richard Mower. This is me and Jem in 1980. That's it. It says, can you ask him if Winkle can have a golden helmet?
Now he can look at it. He's welcome to have a look at it.
There's another one from a friend of yours, Jay Ellis. I think this is Adam Ellis's dad, is it? From John Ellis. Do you remember us trying to buy a pizza before Lariol Grass Track, and you paid with a fake $10 bill that had a naked lady instead of Abraham Lincoln in the middle? The pizza owner loved it. I think it's still pinned to the wall there today.
Yeah, I don't know. Can't remember. It's the red wine's too nice down that part of the world. I can remember every year I used to go to Marmande, and it's always Bastille Day, and just happened to be that everyone was they were all waiting for us coming home, ready for the sort of the mass stock of red wine, because he used to buy half the vineyard out, and they're all waiting for the alcohol for a barbecue when I got home. My dad he used to turn up sort of late, all sort of knackered, and think they're going to help me unload the bikes and put them in the workshop, and they just unloaded the booze and that's it.
Bit of import exports.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Oh, excellent times.
Yeah, well, it's for personal use only.
Yeah, yeah. The bike does run on alcohol, honest.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. It's quality wine, though, down the south of France. In actual fact, I used to go on British Airways flights, and I used to... it wasn't until several years later. Because you could buy the stuff in the early 80s for 50p a bottle, and it's really quality wine, and way ahead of its time. And it wasn't until about 7 or 8 years later I was on a British Airways flight, and they served it with a meal on a... Well, they used to then. They used to give you a meal and a bottle of wine, a small bottle of wine, and it's Côte de Marmandais.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, yeah. So and you won't buy... You won't pay 50p for one now.
Yeah, certainly not on British Airways.
Yeah, but that place used to, that's first rode out about 1978, I think it was, very early, and it's just a track with straw bales around it, and everyone huddled around a big oak tree for some shade to get out of the midday sun. And every year, if they made some money, they invested it into the stadium, and so I've witnessed and watched evolved into an absolute spectacle of under lights, grass track under lights with sort of six corners is something a bit special. If anyone wants to look, well, one of James's tours, he reintroduced it about four or five years ago, and if you love your speedway and you want to see something a bit different, that's probably something you ought to probably go and put on your list.
As you mentioned, Marmande's a different shape of track, isn't it? It's unique.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. It's six corners really. it's more the first and second corner is a corner with a straight in the middle of it. So you got you go in the first corner, clip the apex, run up to the fence, straighten up, and then peel off the fence, and then clip the apex of the second corner going out, and then sort of rub shoulders along the fence going down the straight, and then you hit a normal corner, and the third and fourth corner is a big D-shaped, and you can sort of find the edge of the dirt, and that pulls you around nicely, and then you're back on the starting straight again.
Yeah, there are a few sort of tracks that are slightly different. I've been to Sheffield quite a number of times, and Sheffield's the other way. Sheffield doesn't really have a back straight, does it? It's just kind of, that is like a D shape when you look at it from above.
Yeah, that is a bit of a trick track, Sheffield. It's a bit of a funny one. I never really talked to it. I don't know why. I think because it is narrow, and I found myself following people Do you know what I mean?
It can be a funny one to get a hang of. It seems to be riders that have ridden for Sheffield that come back and do well. You very rarely find riders who have never ridden it doing particularly well on it, you know, on their first go, if you know what I mean. It's one of those that you've got to learn the
learn
sort of
to ride it.
The trick of it, yeah. Yeah.
Learn the lines, yeah. Yeah, it is a bit of a trick, yeah. I can remember going down the British Open with Kai Niemi, and I was so poor. One of the Ipswich supporters travelled up then and said, "You are absolute crap, diabolical." I actually gave the money back.
Right.
Because we were rubbish. Felt so sorry for us. So there is your money back.
Oh, well.
She did laugh.
It's as much as you can do, I suppose, isn't it? I mean, what else can you say?
That's right, yeah. Oh, it's rubbish. Here's your money back. There you go.
Some days it just doesn't happen.
No, you have bad days at the office, don't you? You know, it doesn't. I mean, if we could turn it on all the time, then, well, that'd be great. But no, nobody can. But just proves you are a human and not a machine. Yeah. Always thought Hans was a machine, but he's had a few ups and downs as well.
Hans Nielsen.
He's incredible. You know, more or less like a machine. But point scoring machine, that was. Bet his wife didn't mind cleaning his levers.
I was going to say, it wasn't much to do, was there?
Not really, no.
Very rarely saw Hans Nielsen caked in it.
No, I know.
Yeah.
Yeah, she had an easy time, I think.
This is Humans of Speedway. I'm Ian Brannan. My guest in this episode is a legend of, Ipswich, King's Lynn and England as well. He is Jeremy Doncaster. And right now it's time for Jeremy to give us his Speedway paradise, his dream meeting. Who would ride in it and where would it be? What would it look like in general? He's going to answer a few questions and help us, in our minds at least, dream what Jeremy's meeting would look like in his ideal world. So, Jeremy, first up, the first question will be... as always in this little feature, is which track would you choose to race on? Irrespective of all other facilities that the stadium might have, but the shape and the shale, the track that you would choose for your dream meeting, what would it be?
It doesn't exist anymore, but I'll say we touched on the shale at Halifax, but I think probably at the time the best track to race on was the old Hyde Road at Bellevue. So that's my track.
It's a big old space. That's a bit like Halifax, I suppose, but wider.
Well, the fit thing is that place on the third and fourth corner. I mean, I used to watch PC round there a lot, and by watching it, I learned how to ride the place. And you could make a straight in the middle of the corner on the third and fourth bend. And so if you're coming into that corner last, you can still make it first to the run of the line, you know. So in some respects, it is easier to be behind, so you could make your move on the last corner rather than being in front, not knowing where the other three riders are for four laps. So that's pretty unique.
Good to have the opposition in front so you know where they are.
Where they are, because you know you can make your move whenever you wanted to.
Yeah, well, you certainly seem to be a fan of the bigger circuits than the tighter ones, perhaps. Would that be fair to say?
Well, not really. I used to love Wimbledon. Lovely little place to ride, lovely little trick track. Wolverhampton early on, before they changed it, I liked that track. Always score round Ipswich, although people didn't like it because it was narrow, but it never really appeared narrow to me. It's much, much wider now. It's nearly 2.5 times the width that it used to be today.
Yeah.
And obviously, Reading. We used to joke about the Reading ski jump as he went across the start and into the third corner, but... there's a track that went across that got during the season that it built up more and more as the season went on. So he had a little jump just as he went into the third corner.
Okay, so Hyde Road then, and if we're going to put that in a stadium, any stadium you like, and the surroundings, where would we be putting a Hyde Road?
I reckon if you put it, I mean, I can't really say Cardiff because although I've watched there, I think probably the traditional speedway track has to be outdoors, I think. So I would say on the continent, there's a lovely stadium called Pardubice, which is in Czechoslovakia.
Yeah.
And that under lights with the track of Hyde Road for a traditional stadium where it holds a lot of people. And I think that's your stadium.
Your perfect mix. And Pardubice is where you won the Golden Helmet, of course.
Yeah, a couple of them. Yeah, I did back to back. One when it's a communist country, and the next year when it was democratic.
On to the big question then of your dream 1-7. Any rider, alive or not, no points limits or anything like that. So who would be in your ideal 1-7?
Well, unfortunately, I did jot them down on a notepad, and just my memory's not that great nowadays. It's probably all a few knocks on the head I've had. But the first two are unfortunately no longer with us, but I'd have Billy at number one, Billy Sanders.
Okay.
Number two, Simon Wigg.
Simon Wigg has had a number of nominations for many people that have been guests on this podcast. I mean, I remember him from Bradford, but obviously was a big rider for Oxford and a number of others, wasn't he? But he's got a lot of love and respect for Simon Wigg, a hugely successful rider, but I think the stories come across that he was a nice guy as well.
Yeah, he was. I mean, I did a lot of trips with him. You know, and he's in the Wiggy bus, you know, as we were. And we shared I had a van in Germany once, and we used to fly over on a Sunday morning, and we used to split the expenses going to the meetings, and that worked out quite well for a couple of seasons. So yeah, we spent hours together chatting about the sport and how it can be improved. And so all those, what you see now with the race suit and the team suits, I mean, that was Wiggy's idea, his blueprint he sent to Terry Russell. I don't know what he would be doing now. I would imagine he probably would be involved in the sport, without a doubt. And I think he'd probably... would have a lot of input. Hell of a character. Yeah. And a good, very good long track rider, and equally very good speedway rider. A bit vulnerable on the speedway sometimes. Used to take on a lot, used to take on too many things all at once sometimes. That used to get on top of his mind, you know, at the meeting sometimes. If he just sort of tried a bit too hard sometimes on the media type of things. You can't do it all. You can do it, but not all the time, all of the time, if you know what I mean.
He was very good with a facet of sport that's probably wasn't looked at overly at the time, probably ahead of his game in like branding and marketing and... you know, how he looked all the time. He was always well, everything was always pristine, well presented, and you know, all that kind of thing with the green. You know, you knew who Simon Wigg was on the track without having to look him up. You knew straight away.
Today it's part of the job. If you want to be successful, you've got to base yourself what Simon was doing and how he's presenting himself and portraying himself. But at the time, that was a tough job, you know, to perform and do the media, all that with it at the same time. Mm. Yeah, well, you'd have someone at least helping you do it anyway today.
yeah, I'm sure. Especially now, there's even more stuff to do now than there was then.
Absolutely.
yeah. Okay, so Billy Sanders and Simon Wigg.
Yeah, then we've got Ivan Major. Oh, yeah, that's another one who's sadly no longer with us.
Yeah, well, needs a little introduction, but an amazing ride.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, he used to do a lot of Ivan's tours in the winter time, America and New Zealand and Australia, and the long tracks. Then we've got Peter Collins, the old mate PC.
Yeah, how's he getting on? Do you know at the moment?
Well, I think he's, I'm not sure if he's, he normally goes to Australia this time of the year, but I don't know if he's gone this year or not. I don't know I don't know how they've avoided COVID or not.
I think you can get to Australia, but it's not very easy and you've got to quarantine for quite a while, but I think it is possible.
Mm. So. I think there's probably less of it over there than certainly over here anyway.
But. Yeah. I would hope that's the case. It's I think we're certainly leading the world in the amount of COVID cases. Apart from Russia, apparently, who are firmly in the lead. Anyway, Peter Collins.
Then we get to the modern day riders. Now we've got Jason Crump.
Yes. Yeah. Jason Crump's a big fan of yours, isn't he?
He rode in my farewell. Yeah. I took Jason to his first continental meeting, actually. So, go back a long way. So, it's a lot of good memories for Jason. Then we've got Chris Louis, who's, part family. And Mark Loram. And that's seven, isn't it?
That's seven.
What about a reserve?
Go on there, an extra one.
Number eight, Amanda Castagna.
just to keep the FIM happy.
Yeah, there we go.
Well, I've just put on Twitter that I was going to be talking to you, and while we've been speaking, I've had a like from Paco Castagna, so maybe word's getting back to the big man.
Yeah, probably. They're lovely family, all of them. His brothers. Superb, the whole family. Mariano, they're great. Well, Milo's brother Paolo used to ride, and Mariano, in actual fact, I borrowed Mariano's bike in for the Golden Gala once in a 10 year in Italy, and he was packing up and his bike was up for sale and he couldn't sell it, and mine was playing up, so borrowed his for the final, won the final, and he sold it for twice the money. So he's chuffed as anything.
Oh, that's good. Increasing the value.
It did, yeah.
So for your meeting then with all these stars, who would be the referee? Did you ever have one that you preferred to be looking after the meetings you were involved in?
Yeah, it's got to be Graham Brody, the wing commander. I can remember having he was refereeing a meeting at Hackney once, and it was Ipswich v Hackney, and Andy Galvin was the number one, and I was riding for Ipswich, and typical thing, first heat, Andy ended up on his arse, and first turn bunching, so it's called back. And Simo was a team manager, and I knew Simo really well as well. And I could see him talking to him, and I could lip read him, and he's saying, "Don't let him get, drop it on him, get over on the front of him." And I knew exactly what he was going to try and do. So, anyway, started again, and I wasn't having any of it. So, and he, ended up on the deck again. So, Graham got us both on the. I think it might have been three. Reruns, and then Graham got us both on the phone, and I explained the situation to him. I said, "Well, it's Simo, telling Andy to drop his shoulder on me to stop us going into the first corner." So then he had a word with Andy and said, "Look," he said, "if you don't, the pair of you don't get round the first and second corner, I'm just going to put you both out. So so we did. I think it was a third or fourth attempt anyway. But very fair referee. There's not many referees who would have a conversation like that.
Yeah, we'll give you fair warning of and three chances to have a go at it.
That's it, absolutely.
Yeah. And while we're on that subject, actually, speaking of starts, it's something I haven't asked you about. You are probably known for your starts as much as any of your skills, really, but you've always been a fast starter out of the gate. Is there a particular technique that you use, or were you just naturally lightning reflexes, or
no? I think that there is a technique, and I've tried to teach people, and I've tried to explain it to them, and I don't think there is anyone who starts the same. You know, it is fairly unique, I guess. But maybe some of the guys in the 70s were started like that. Maybe Ollie did, because he used to slip the clutch. And that's basically what I do, slip the clutch off the start. So, and don't start with sort of like 13,000 RPM. I start very, very, not a lot of motor, and just sort of, just ride the clutch to the corner.
And sort of accelerate into the bend a little bit, is that?
Yeah.
Rather than sort of a full drop.
Yeah, that's right. A bit more control. You've got more chance of controlling your wheel spin, and you've got better chance of moving your weight if it does start to claw up.
Yeah, it's simple science, isn't it? It's just balance and weight, really, for a speedway bike to make it work. But it sort of evades some people, perhaps.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, that's obviously I've described it in simpler terms as I can, which sounds very straightforward, but it is basically straightforward. But it's if it's an unnatural thing to do, it's very difficult to actually to do it. You know, to teach it, because naturally, if someone's revving a bike alongside you, you give it more revs and you've got to ignore everything you sort of what's going on next to you and just concentrate and listen to what your motor's doing.
Yeah, we're hard to tune into, and when you've got three other bikes at the side of you kicking out some noise and vibrations as well.
Yeah, it's a vibration and noise and the nerves. You know, it's very easy to sort of just give it a little twerk, and you can easily put on 10,000 revs without really trying very hard at all.
Yeah. So that's the referee anyway, and if you could change a rule of Speedway to improve it for the betterment, if we could go straight to Armando Castagna's door, what might that be?
I think it's got to be the recently the anticipation of the starts. I think because probably I know I said I'd slip the clutch and ride it to the corner. I always used to anticipate the starts as well. I used to watch the referee and count in my head and have a timing and have a feel for when they're going to hit the tapes. Particularly racing on the continent, you had to predict. You could actually charge the tapes and referee would panic and push the tapes up. And I think if I was riding today, I'd probably get put out of more times of races than I've actually get to the corner. So yeah, I was a lightning starter, but I'd say I probably used to thinking of it, I probably used to predict starts, which I think if you can get away with it, if you touch tapes right, you've blown it, you know. But if you can predict it and then you can get away with it. Fair play. You know, you've earned, you've done your job.
Yeah, it's a point that's been made a few times, actually. I think Phil Morris was one of the strongest on this, saying that he's done a lot of research, and the amount of time between the green light going on and the tapes going up has got shorter over the years. And now it's a lot easier for the riders to sort of guess, and maybe the the tapes should be held longer, yeah, or they should be put on a timer so it's taken out of the a randomizer, so the referee presses a button and there's perhaps a delay before the tapes go up, so it's harder for the riders to guess. That was just what you were saying.
I think they did have them on a timer once. I mean, you could easily do that actually, just sort of hit the button and it randomly does a short or a long one. It probably frustrate the riders to hell. But certainly, with the tape going up quicker, if they're going up within 2 seconds, you can sort of, it's very unusual that they're going to go up on the first second, but there's a good chance that if you count one and then start to sort of think about dropping the clutch, you could probably get it before they go up before 2 seconds. You see what I'm saying?
And if your wheel's far enough behind, you're probably not going to touch the tapes anyway. If they were going to go up around then, so you don't have to be bang on, but you might benefit from it.
Absolutely, yeah. So there's a couple of changes you could do, but basically the starting technique. Where the line is, and probably go back to a longer pause. I mean, you shouldn't be doing 13 RPM at a start anyway. I mean, it's sort of the engine tuners are rubbing their hands together, or pulling the hair out.
It's a very good point. The stage set then for your dream meeting, Jeremy Doncaster. We've got your all-time 1-7. It's going to be on the Hyde Road track in Pardubice Stadium in the Czech Republic. But who is going to be the opposition? Now, a team that you rode in, that Reading team of 92, has been said to be the ultimate opposition a couple of times. Which opposition are you going to go for in yours?
It gave it a lot of thought, and I thought, well... And that kept coming to Reading, back to Reading. I mean, there's been some very strong Ipswich sides. and I think, yeah, Reading 92 side against that side, I think that would be a real good meeting, good match.
And Armando Castagna would definitely get a ride then.
I'd put them in, yes. Well, I'd have to, wouldn't I? Actually have a... because I've got several deceased riders, I could actually have an 8 and a 9, couldn't I? And I could have Dennis Segalas as a second reserve, couldn't I?
Yeah, well, he's always an entertainer.
Yeah, or John Cook as well. So, well, I've got 3 deceased, so I could have, Siggy and with Mondo, Siggy and Cookie, that would substitutes as well. So I think that'd be quite good.
It sounds like a good meeting. I think you'll certainly sell some tickets.
Yeah. Trying to get them to ride, we might have had a few seances.
It's possibly so. Jeremy Doncaster, it's been fantastic speaking with you. Thanks very much for sharing some of those great stories with us. I'm sure that people will have found it as fascinating as I have.
More than welcome. More than welcome. There's a load more, but I'll just bore you in the end.
Are there any good ones that we haven't asked?
No, they come out ever so randomly. Memories sort of, they're there somewhere, but I don't know. Sometimes you just have to, I think all the guys are the same. You sort of like, a few of you get together and then they're just, you get little snippet come out, and then you have to tell that little story, and
it just flows from there. Kind
of, it just follows on then.
No, it's been great, and I say there has been quite a few people asking. I put a post on a little while ago about who should I speak to, and you were suggested by quite a few. So I'm sure that people will enjoy hearing your tales over the time, and been great speaking to you.
Brilliant. All right then, Ian. Okay, thanks. Enjoy doing it. Thanks very much.
My thanks to Jeremy Doncaster for joining us on this episode of Humans of Speedway. And thank you to you as well for listening. Of course, if you have enjoyed it, please leave us a 5-star review. And don't forget to subscribe as well, so you get new episodes direct into your podcast player of choice, whatever that might be. You can also check out previous episodes too if you're one of our new subscribers. Don't forget, there's loads for you to have a look at. Kelvin Tatum was an episode we did just before Christmas. You can also hear from Gary Havelock, Roy Clark, Phil Morris, Nigel Pearson, Shane Parker, Neil Machin. There's all sorts of stuff on there, and plenty more to come as well. So do follow us on our social media channels as well. We are at Speedway Humans on Twitter, and if you search for Humans of Speedway on Facebook and Instagram, if you're on either of those, get regular posts there as well. And something new from Humans of Speedway: if you are an Amazon Alexa owner, there's a new skill that you can get if you search for Speedway News, and then if you ask your device, "What's the latest Speedway news?" I won't say the name because I don't want to trigger all of your smart speakers off if you're in earshot of them right now. Then it should bring you an update. Just search for Speedway News in the skills, add it, activate it, and then there'll be updates every day as we go through the season. That's the plan. So get in there and be an early adopter and see if it works, and let us know what you think of that. In the meantime, take care, stay safe, and we'll be back soon with more Humans of Speedway.